I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, can music overcome politics? The Venezuelan party band Los Amigos Invisibles certainly hope so.
Dormir en tu seno, solo tuyo seré. Viviré para ti.
A special in-studio performance is coming up later in this program. But first, we're going to check in on a couple of important international stories. Almost 2 months have passed since a deadly earthquake rocked Haiti and flattened its capital, Port-au-Prince, and killed an estimated 200,000 people. Today, the president of Haiti, René Préval, meets with President Barack Obama to talk about what needs to be done next in the recovery efforts. To bring us up to date, we called Jonathan Katz, a Haiti-based correspondent for the Associated Press, and he's with us now on the phone from Port-au-Prince, the capital. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, just to set the table, Jonathan, you've been in Haiti for a couple of years now. You were there during the earthquake. What do you think is the biggest change from the immediate aftermath of the earthquake to now?
There's really no comparison. I mean, some rubble's been cleared from the streets, so it's a bit easier to get around. But the biggest thing is that in the days after, it was an absolute nightmare. There were piles of bodies in the streets, especially starting a couple days after. There was a horrible, acrid smell wafting everywhere. It was really a nightmare zone for a couple of weeks, and we're beyond that at this point, but there's obviously clearly quite a lot of work left to be done.
What would you say is the biggest need right now?
I mean, one of the most immediate things that you see when you're riding around is the need for shelter. At this point, the international community has basically embarked on a project to give people plastic tarps. There's about 1.2 million people who've been displaced, made homeless by the earthquake. As of now, an estimated half of those have received either a tent and, for the most part, these plastic tarps. That's not much of a shelter to begin with, but it's better than nothing. And so you still have, you know, half a million people or more who don't have that.
As I mentioned, today, President Préval is meeting with President Obama, but he met with the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, yesterday. And one of the things he said in that meeting is that reconstruction shouldn't be focused solely on Port-au-Prince, the capital, even though there was significant damage there. But he said that rebuilding efforts should really spread out around the country. I'll just play a short clip from what he said at a press conference yesterday, speaking through an interpreter. Here it is.
In the past, everything had been concentrated and focused on the capital, where the political and economic elites of the country live, and the rest of the country was neglected. So this is an opportunity to not only rebuild Port-au-Prince, but first and foremost to invest and to rebuild in the provinces.
Is it surprising to hear him say that? And is that a view that is widely shared?
No, it's not surprising at all. That is a view that's very widely held, not just among Haitians, but among the international community as well. There has been so much centralization, first of all, on the part of the international community in bringing aid in, but also on the part of the Haitian government, which, of course, for many, many years was a dictatorship and tried to concentrate itself as much as possible in the capital. And so unlike many other countries that you might go to, you really can't get very much done outside of the capital. And the international community has responded to that over the years by also focusing its aid here. And what's happened here is, first of all, you have several towns, Léogang, Carrefour, Périgueux, other towns like that have been affected very seriously by the earthquake. You also have more than half a million people, I think it's around 600,000, who have left the capital to go to other parts of the country. And so even though those parts of the country weren't affected directly by earthquake damage, they're now struggling with extreme poverty and trying to feed and house and clothe the people who have come in from the capital. And so that's a real problem for them, too.
And President Préval said last week that Haiti does not need any more food aid because that would undermine local food growers and producers. But I also heard you say at the beginning of our conversation that people are still struggling with basics, like getting adequate food and certainly shelter, as you just told us. So what is the thinking there now about how basic needs should be addressed? If he doesn't think more aid is needed, are the local growers and producers in a position to meet the need?
They're not, but that's the point. It sounds contradictory, but if you look at the past in Haiti, this is a country that has received so much international aid. And beyond international aid, the market has also been flooded, especially over the last 20 years or so, by heavily subsidized agricultural products. One of the most famous examples, the most prevalent examples, is rice from the United States. And it actually sells for cheaper here on the streets of Haiti than Haitian rice does, which has over time driven Haitian rice growers essentially out of business.
And Jonathan, finally, before we let you go, I did want to mention that I think you were the sole American reporter permanently based in Haiti before the earthquake. You'd been there for a number of years before the earthquake hit. You were also affected by the earthquake. Your living quarters, your office were damaged like that of so many, many other people. You've had a lot of company since the earthquake. A lot of American reporters have come in and all these other people. And now a lot of these people are starting to leave. And I just wanted to ask, what's this experience been like for you?
It's been intense, in a word. The day of the earthquake itself was, despite the fact that I've been here through, a number of natural disasters and rising and waning international attention, both from the media and from other internationals, as you said, nothing has compared to this. It was an astounding experience, the earthquake itself. It was absolutely terrifying in its first moments, and it's been sort of alternatingly terrifying and fascinating since.
Jonathan Katz is a correspondent for the Associated Press. He is based in Haiti, and he was kind enough to join us on the phone from there. Jonathan, I thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now to Nigeria, where another round of sectarian violence has shocked the country and the international community. On Sunday, near the city of Jos in central Nigeria, a group of Muslim herders reportedly attacked several Christian villages with guns and machetes, reportedly killing hundreds of people, including many women and children. It's believed to have been an act of reprisal for an earlier attack in January that left hundreds of Muslim villagers dead. This is only the latest bloody episode in an ongoing series of clashes that have left thousands dead over the last decade. Obviously, one wants to know why. So to answer some of these questions, we've invited Eliza Griswold. She's a Swartz Fellow at the New America Foundation and author of the upcoming book, The Tenth Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Line Between Christianity and Islam. For years, Eliza has been traveling in Africa and Southeast Asia, studying the intersection between the two faiths, and she's with us now from New York. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle, for having me.
So first of all, do you know what set off this latest round in Nigeria?
It seems that this latest round was set off as reprisal killings, that there was some violence perpetrated by Christians several months ago, and that these latest killings were in reprisal for that.
As I've mentioned, this has been going on for a decade. One act of violence begets another act of violence. And so this has been this sort of ongoing cycle. Do you have any sense of what started this in this particular region?
In this particular region, the end of military dictatorship in 1999 and the opening up of democratic space paradoxically helped to lead to religious violence as different groups started to vie over who would hold power. Plateau State, in which Jos is located, is part of the Middle Belt, which is the space where Christianity and Islam largely meet.
We say that this is religiously inspired, but what does that mean?
On one hand, one doesn't want to oversubscribe this kind of violence to religion because it has so many complex causes rooted in resource conflict and also longstanding ethnic division. At the same time, when the killings begin, religion does become the marker by which people kill and protect each other. So, whether one is a Christian or Muslim does become the dividing line, especially in the Middle Belt. In Nigeria in general, people's rights are tied to something called indigenship, meaning whoever can claim they came first from the land itself has the rights to scholarship, jobs, and help from the state. Plateau is particularly fraught because both these Christian and Muslim groups claim that they came from there first. So this issue of indigenship underlies a lot of the conflict. Whoever gets this right to say, I came here first, this is my home, and they use religion to undergird those claims, they get the right to basically the help from the weak state.
And what's the government's role in all of this? Is the apparatus of government controlled by one or the other group? Is power shared? What role does government authority play in this?
Really, one of the leading causes of this violence is the weak democratic state and democratic in name only that Nigeria is. Over the past several years, state officials in Nigeria, the government officials, have embezzled between $4 to $8 billion annually, according to Human Rights Watch. So being in the government is basically a passport to wealth. The way that that functions from a state-to-state level is that in the Middle Belt, in Plateau State, the government is Christian, but this is the southern edge historically of the Muslim North, and so there is a lot of historical anti-Northern, anti-Islamic sentiment saying, you know, you enslaved us as ethnic minorities for centuries, and we now will defend ourselves by defending our faith, defending our Christian faith against the incursion of Islam. And actually, in Plateau State, the Muslims are the minority, and so they end up in a position where they frequently don't get rights to things as very fundamental as land, water, electricity, and these small-scale conflicts explode with some frequency.
And finally, Eliza, any number of parts of the world, people complain, all that we ever hear is this cycle of violence, that cycle of violence. Is there any effort being made to intervene in this cycle? Are we just going to see this for a while?
Unfortunately, Michelle, the answer is yes. Nigeria's problems, many emanating from its vast oil wealth. You know, it's Nigeria is now the fifth largest supplier of oil to the United States. And as we've seen in so many other places, oil wealth being a curse rather than a blessing largely. So my sense is, I mean, international pressure or international interest goes where the money is, and that's primarily the Delta, and that's primarily oil. So in places where, like the Middle Belt, there's very little oversight. And while we may have concern at a distance, oh my gosh, how is this happening again? On the ground, there are almost no social institutions to address the cessation of violence.
Eliza Griswold is a Schwartz Fellow at the New America Foundation. She's the author of the forthcoming book, The 10th Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Line Between Christianity and Islam. And she was kind enough to join us on the phone from New York. I thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. It's almost that time again, census time. Every 10 years, the Constitution requires the U.S. government to count its citizens and others living within its borders. And next week, most Americans will get that form in the mail. Now, we've been talking a lot on this program about why the census matters and to whom, how the census is carried out, and what experts believe the new census may show. In a few minutes, we'll talk about the fact that this may be the year that the number of babies born to so-called minorities outnumber the number of babies born to whites. That's a little later, but first we want to talk more about how race is described in the census. Previously, we've talked about how some Arab Americans are disturbed that there is no specific box for them to check. They are expected to check white, along with others of European, Middle Eastern, or North African descent. But a group of Arab American leaders in Orange County, California, says that means the actual number of Arab Americans is likely to be misrepresented, particularly underrepresented. So they've launched a campaign with the Census Bureau's support to encourage Arab Americans to check the box Other. And their campaign is called Check It Right, You Ain't White. I'm joined now by the co-chair of the Arab Complete Count Committee in Orange County, Omar Masri. And he's also a city planner for the city of Irvine, California. And he's with us now from member station KUCI. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Omar, how did you figure out that this was something important to work on, that this is something you wanted to focus on?
Well, it was important to me way before this all started. I remember when I was 17 and filling out forms to join the military or to apply for colleges, and I would see no box for my group. I'd see for all kinds of other groups, and I felt it was an opportunity missed to express or to identify myself.
Why do you think it's important, though, specifically to be counted as a person of Middle Eastern descent or Arab American? Some people feel that, you know, white is perfectly fine. In fact, there are some people who feel, let's just be honest, that being white conveys certain advantages in this society.
That's true. And having grown up in the suburbs between L.A. and Santa Barbara, I basically felt like more like a white kid because I grew up in an all-white community. And as Arab Americans, we kind of see ourselves as trying to go on that trajectory for the American dream and kind of matching the white group, if you will, in many respects. But at the same time, we do feel like we're this anonymous minority. When something bad happens, we seem to get magnified, but when there's an opportunity, it seems like we're marginalized. So we look at this census as an opportunity to say, hey, we're here, we should be counted.
So what is this, how is this campaign working? The check it right, you ain't white. Now, it's attention getting, I have to say. Got our attention.
It's very tongue-in-cheek. We're really just trying to get people to pay attention and perk up and say, hey, maybe it's an opportunity for me to express myself. And we're trying to approach people on different levels. Obviously, the big elephant in the room is concerns over profiling, especially after 9/11. And one of the things we like to do is use humor to kind of disarm people. Oftentimes tell Arab American parents and our older generation, the first generation that came here, that, hey, there's probably more information on your kid's Facebook page than there is of information you're really willing to give out. And plus, you know, the census form is not the end-all be-all if the government, if you will, wants to get information on you. We also try to reach out and convey that there's advantages for your community, the kind of parks you get, the kind of amenities you get, the CDBG funds given out by Congress in order to distribute federal funds for community development block grants are all based on census numbers. So it matters whatever you fill it out as, but it does matter that you fill it out.
But the government doesn't give out parks based on being, you know, an Arab American. Do you see what I'm saying? So what is the hook to tell people why they need specifically to describe their racial or ethnic identity in this way?
Well, it's a twofold approach. Obviously, the parks aren't given out based on different groups, but CDBG funds and other funds for communities might be dispersed differently if it's found that there's different groups. Arab Americans, we like to see ourselves as being an entrepreneurial class, so maybe if there's more Arab Americans in the community, it might mean there's more opportunities for small business loans and small business startup grants. In addition, we think it's important to know where we stand. One of the questions that's often posed to me by Arab Americans is, does this mean we're going to get preferences for minority hiring, things like that? And the question I have, or the answer I have, is we don't know, because we don't know where we stand socioeconomically, if you will. Are we more like quote-unquote white people, or are we more disadvantaged than we assume?
Okay, I get that. And final question, very briefly, if you will. What reaction are you getting so far to this campaign?
Most people are amused, taken aback by it for a second, and then realize where we're going with it. And it's a positive campaign, trying to reach out to our community and get them involved.
All right. Omar Masri is the co-chair of the Arab Complete Count Committee in Orange County, California. He's also a city planner for the city of Irvine, and he joined us from member station KUCI in Irvine. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
No matter what box any of us decides to check when that form finally arrives, one thing is clear: the all-American look is about to change. A new research paper titled Growing Diversity Among America's Children and Youth, recently published in the journal Population and Development Review, describes just how fast America's racial makeup is changing, especially among children and youth. The paper says that the rapid increase, particularly in the number of Hispanic children born in the U.S., along with the decline in the number of non-Hispanic white children being born, means, according to the report, that in many parts of the United States, the future is now. Joining us now to talk more about this is one of the study's co-authors, the University of New Hampshire's Professor Kenneth Johnson. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Hello, Michelle.
So, Professor, we've been hearing this for some time now. We've been hearing that the racial and ethnic minorities, or so-called minorities, we probably have to come up with a new term, right, will become the majority population in 2042. So what does your paper tell us that is different?
Well, I think what it tells us is that for young children in the United States, that future is almost here right now. Last year, 48% of the babies born in the United States were a minority. That is, they were not non-Hispanic white. And 46% of the youngest children are members of minority, compared to only 31% of the population over the age of 20. So what we think is that the population is going to become more diverse, essentially from youngest to oldest.
And is this a national phenomenon, or is this a geographic phenomenon? Where are we likely to see this? Are we going to see this all over the country?
Well, it's occurring in differential ways across the country. There are 500 counties in the United States in which minority children are already the majority of all children in the county, and there are another 300 where minority children are very near the majority. In contrast, there are only 300 counties where overall there are more minority people than non-Hispanic white. So you can see that geographically it's much more dispersed than it is for the adult population. Now, there are still large parts of the United States which are primarily non-Hispanic white, and there are other parts which are extremely diverse. So this is a big country, and the spatial distributions differ from place to place.
Is there anything in this that surprised you? I understand that the study is based on existing data.
Yes, it is. It's not based on projections. It's the data that we have at hand now, although your last speaker talking about the census really emphasizes the point that if we really want to understand what's happening, we really need everybody to fill this new census out so that demographers will have the latest data from a head count, not from estimates, to try and make sure we understand what's happening.
I understand, but is there something new to you?
Because
there's a sense of urgency to your paper that I wanted to try to capture,
right.
And that's what I'm trying to get at.
Right. Mm-hmm. And the two most surprising findings to me, and I'm a demographer who has been watching American demographic trends for my whole career, was number one, that there are not only is the diversity coming because there are more minority children, but because there are fewer non-Hispanic white children being born. There are, since 2000, there have been about 4.8 million more minority children born and 2.6 million fewer non-Hispanic white children born. And as we look deeper into this, one of the reasons that that's happening is because the number of non-Hispanic white women of prime childbearing age between the age of 20 and 39 has been diminishing. It's down 20% since 1990. That's 5.6 million fewer non-Hispanic white women in their prime childbearing years. And as we look to the future, to the 10 to 19-year-old girls who will be the next generation of mothers, there only are about as many of them among non-Hispanic whites as there are among women of childbearing age now. So it's not as if there's going to be a big surge in them. In contrast, among the number of minority women of prime childbearing age, there are 4.5 million more in 2008 than there were just in 2000. And that's a 40% increase. I'm sorry, that's wrong. That's 4.5 million more since 1990, which is a 40% gain. So to me and to my co-author Dan Lichter at Cornell, the surprising thing was that this is coming both because there are more minority children, which everybody knew, but also because the number of non-Hispanic white children is not as great as it was.
And also the number of Asian children, too. You point out that the number of Asian children are being born is not replacing what you call replacement levels. And so finally...
That it's more complicated than that. It's correct that the fertility levels of the Asian population are at replacement level. But the Asian population is also being replenished because there are immigrants coming to the United States from Asian countries. And so they are actually producing more Asian children than there were being produced earlier in the decade.
Well, I guess it makes me wonder whether we're going to have to come up with new terms.
Yeah, maybe so. You know, as a demographer, my main worry is about the data. But you're right that it's becoming a little bit awkward to talk about minority-majority counties. So maybe so.
Have you come up with any ideas for us?
Oh, ma'am, my job is just to work with the data, not worry about new titles.
Maybe we could work Kenneth into it?
Maybe.
A Kenneth.
Well, the Kenneth demographic trend.
The Kenneth demographic trend, does that kind of work for you? Okay, Kenneth Johnson is a professor of sociology at the University of New Hampshire. He co-authored a new study about changes in the U.S. demographic makeup. That paper is called Growing Diversity Among America's Children and Youth. If you'd like to read it for yourself, we'll have a link on our website at npr.org. Click on Programs, then on Tell Me More, and he joined us on the phone from his office. Professor Johnson, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
We often talk about freedom in this country, but do you ever think about what you would do to be free? Well, imagine putting yourself in a box 3 feet long, 2 feet 8 inches deep, and barely 2 feet wide. Now imagine sending that box to Pennsylvania from Richmond, Virginia by rail. That's exactly what the enslaved American Henry Brown did in March of 1849, a feat that was both an amazing and harrowing journey, so much so that Henry Brown adopted the middle name Box to commemorate his path to freedom. For many years, the man who received Brown's delivery remained mostly silent. James Miller McKim, a white abolitionist, documented the account in a letter to a friend, but he wrote, "And now I have one request. For heaven's sake, don't publish this affair or allow it to be published." But recently, the letter was made available to the New York Times by the New York Historical Society. Naturally, we wanted to know more, so we've called Jeffrey Ruggles, author of the book, The Unboxing of Henry Brown, and a curator at the Virginia Historical Society, and he's with us now. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
How did you find out about this?
Well, it started out as a local history story in Richmond, Virginia, and as I looked into it more and more, the story just grew and grew.
Did anybody not believe it? I mean, it's often that many of these stories were considered apocryphal at the time, or they were considered just to make a point about the horrors of slavery. And it's often been years before people realize these things actually did happen. So was it known at the time that Henry Brown's story was in fact true?
Well, despite the feelings of some people that the journey should remain secret so that other slaves might have an opportunity to escape, publicity about Brown's escape came pretty quickly after. He escaped at the end of March, and by May, he was appearing at a large anti-slavery convention in Boston and was lauded in the press for his exploit.
So who thought it should remain secret? He evidently did not. Who didn't think it should be known?
Well, Brown didn't really get to make the call. Within the abolitionist movement, there were several different camps of thought. Frederick Douglass is well known as somebody who thought that it should not have been made public, whereas there were other abolitionists, mostly white, who thought it would be good publicity. It was such a good story. And actually, the way that it came out, it was just people couldn't keep from telling the story.
So what did Brown do after he reached freedom?
He went on the abolitionist speaking circuit. He had a song that he had sung upon his arrival in Philadelphia. He performed that at anti-slavery meetings. He published a slave narrative of his life and his escape. And eventually he produced a moving panorama on slavery.
That was a form of theater, as I understand it, that was popular at the time. It involved what, like a moving backdrop or something like that?
It was like a giant scroll with paintings, and it was really more like a slideshow because they would have one painted image and then they'd wind to the next image. Brown made one about slavery, about Africans in freedom in Africa being enslaved and brought to America, and then the trials of families being split up, stories of escapes, and then ended up with his escape to freedom.
As I understand it, he had to leave the country for a time because he escaped in 1849, which was just before the Fugitive Slave Act was passed in 1850. So he went to England. What did he do there? And did he eventually come back?
He was forced to go to England. He took his moving panorama with him, and he went on to the show circuit in Great Britain. He was on the circuit for 25 years. Eventually, he returned to the United States in 1875.
So why do you think his story has remained in relative obscurity all of these years? I take your point that there was a split over whether this was a really good idea to disclose the circumstances or not, because it would, by publicizing it, it would make it harder for other people to follow in his footsteps, which were hard enough to do. But why do you think that it isn't that well known?
I think there are a couple reasons. One, the fact that he went to Great Britain, and he was sort of separated from the rest of the abolitionist movement, the anti-slavery movement, not coming back till the 1870s. So that's part of it. Part of it also is the personality of Brown. Now, Brown was really pretty much of a working-class guy, and most of the people in the anti-slavery movement were very well-educated. A lot of them were involved in the temperance movement. Some of them wouldn't even read novels. And Brown was much more of a guy of the people. He would go into a pub, throw some dice, and the way he behaved really didn't suit some of the folks in the anti-slavery movement. When he went to Great Britain, in fact, he kind of split altogether from the anti-slavery folks, and he just went into the popular theater side. And I think most of the history has been written from the papers of the abolitionists and the anti-slavery folks, who were very literate and saved a lot of things.
So finally, as somebody who appreciates history, what do you find most compelling about Henry Brown's story?
Well, I think that the escape in the box, as miraculous as it was really only the beginning of Brown's story. And it's the way that he fashioned for himself a new life. He had great imagination. He didn't just show the moving panorama. He became an electrobiologist, which is a kind of a show in those days. He became a magician. He created himself a new life. And I think if Brown were alive today, the kind of power that he had and the imagination, I think we would have all heard of him.
I think he'd be Jay-Z.
Well.
or Puff Daddy.
Could be. I really think that's the kind of guy he was.
Jeffrey Ruggles is a curator at the Virginia Historical Society. He's author of the book, The Unboxing of Henry Brown, an enslaved American who packaged himself and sent himself to freedom by train. Mr. Ruggles is with us from WCVE in Richmond. If you want to see a picture of Henry Brown, there's a lithograph at the Virginia Historical Society site. We'll link to it. Just go to npr.org, click on programs, then on Tell Me More. Mr. Ruggles, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Just ahead, we whisk you away from politics and pain with the fun and funky rhythms of Los Amigos Invisibles.
We're a party band, first and foremost.
Get ready to get loose. That's coming up on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. When the Venezuelan band Los Amigos Invisibles began playing music in the early 90s, they were literally invisible to most people out there. Their first gigs were in underground dance parties throughout Caracas. But after a move to Brooklyn in 1997, they emerged into the spotlight when they caught the ear of David Byrne, the legendary former frontman for the group Talking Heads. Since then, the group has created 5 studio albums, all featuring a funky mix of house, acid jazz, and Latin disco. They're on tour now supporting their 5th album titled Comercial, which won them a Latin Grammy for Best Alternative Album. And they're with us now in our Washington, D.C. studios to perform songs from the album and tell us a little bit about themselves. Armando Figueredo, the keyboardist, is going to introduce everybody. Welcome, everybody.
Hello. Thanks for having us here, Michelle. I'm I'm keyboard player Armando. To my right is Cheo, guitar player, Julio on lead vocals, Katire on bass, Mamel on drums, and then Mauricio on bongos.
All right. Welcome, everybody. Thank you for joining us. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
So how did you come up with your name?
Actually, a friend of ours came up with the name, but it comes from a TV show that we used to watch as kids. It was a history show, and basically the announcer would introduce the program addressing the invisible people that were watching him. So he would say, good night, my invisible friends, and then continue on with the show. So
there was a recent interview in Miami New Times. They called you Venezuelan anti-heroes, and it says that you're not producing the traditional rock and salsa that many people associate with the Latin sound. So I wanted to ask, how do you describe your sound?
We're a party band, first and foremost. Some people have called us like Latin funk or dance funk or whatever. We began with the acid jazz movement. In the UK, we were inspired by it, bands like Brand New Heavies, Jamiroquai, et cetera, et cetera. And that what meant dance music with a jazz twist, with electric guitar, keyboards, and so on and so forth. But eventually, we actually got back into our roots, and we do incorporate some salsa over here and there, and merengue, and, you know, bossa nova, all of that.
But when you started out, starting out wanting to...
Yeah, it was
make a
much...
break from what people think Latin music is, or was it just that's what you like?
Well, back in our country, there were 2 kinds of bands playing around. It was either like rock bands on a more either goth or, you know, heavy metal kind of spectrum, or there were salsa and merengue kind of bands, and we were in between.
I wanted to ask Cheo a question. One song that has been winning over fans has been Mentiras, which means... lies.
Well, it became like a thing to party and then to be tagged on the social networks like Facebook or High Five. So, you know, something happened in a party in República Dominicana where we like we had these pictures with these ladies, nothing bad happening, nothing to regret or anything. But, you know, we were like approached by our girlfriend saying, you know, like you were partying until late in this place and whatever. And we were like, no, that's a lie. That wasn't me. It looks like me, but it's not me.
It wasn't really me.
No, not at all.
Really?
Like, no, I'm
can
tagged,
we second
but
source
I mean,
that?
I have the same T-shirt and I have the same, like, afro and stuff. But it's
everybody's
not
telling
me.
The same story here. Okay,
well,
okay, I'm
yeah,
just making
yeah, we
sure.
We were working late.
Oh, okay. But that's where the song came from?
No, I wasn't even there.
It wasn't even there. But it was a number one hit, right?
Yeah,
in Venezuela? Okay.
Yeah.
All right, so can we hear it?
Yes.
All right,
sure.
Hear it. Let's hear it.
La 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 la. Esas son puras mentiras. Esa noche yo no andaba ahí. Debes estar confundida. No había un tipo igualito a mí. Esas son puras mentiras. Esa noche yo no andaba ahí. Debes estar confundida. No había un tipo igualito a mí. Te cuentan que me vieron paseando en la ciudad con una ropa fina y con cara de galán, mirando a todas las chicas pasar frente a mí, pero eso es imposible, yo nunca estuve allí. Cuando no estás conmigo yo me porto bien, me quedo encerrado viendo la TV, no salgo ni a la esquina ni hablo con mi vecina, aunque no te lo niego, sigue estando divina. Esas son puras mentiras. Esa noche yo no andaba allí. Debes estar confundida. No había un tipo igualito a
veces que me viste en una página web con dos evas al lado y una birra también, que estaba muy contento y como distraído. Te juro, yo esa hora estaba más que dormido. No sé de qué me hablas, yo no sé qué pasa. Tú siempre por ahí, yo tranquilo en mi casa, leyéndome unos libros pa' poder comprender cómo debo tratarte y entenderte, mujer. Esas son puras mentiras. Esa noche yo no andaba allí. Debes estar confundida. O había un tipo igualito a mí. Esas son puras mentiras. No, no. Esa noche yo no andaba, yo no andaba, yo no andaba. Debes estar confundida. O había un tipo igualito a mí.
That was hot. Thank you. Thank Welcome. You for that. Thank you. And congratulations while I'm at it on the first Latin Grammy.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, congratulations, which you won for this album back in November. You know, Armando, you've been nominated, what, four times? Previously?
This was the third on the Latin Grammys and then two on the American.
And the first win. Now, I know a lot of artists have ambivalent feelings about prizes and things like that, but I do wonder, what do you think the difference is that took you over the top for this one?
It is nice to be recognized, even more fabulous to win, and it obviously is something to put on your resume. I mean, you can see it at this beginning of the year for us has been a lot more hectic than it should be, but of course we don't produce music or compose music thinking that you're gonna get a Grammy. You just compose it because it's what you do and what you like doing.
Chair, what do you think?
I was just going to add to that, the most beautiful thing about the Grammys was what it meant for Venezuela, our hometown. Like, people got really excited about it. And even though, like, we have, like, mixed opinions about awards and prizes and everything, like, the fact that Venezuela was so happy for us and, like, we became, like, such a great news for our country, it was, like, actually really beautiful. And it made the Grammy, like, have, like, a different meaning for us now.
Yeah. You know, what do you think you won this time? Any idea?
Longevity is one of the things I think made the difference. We've been out there and doing noise for a long time. And then I guess actually this record, pun intended, commercial, is actually the most commercial record we've done so far in our career.
And are you okay with that?
Yeah, we are all okay. We thought about it. We're like, yeah, let's do it. This is how it sounds. Just accept what it is and put it out there. It's commercial.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm visiting with Los Amigos Invisibles. They're on tour supporting their album, Comercial. It's a Latin Grammy award-winning album, and they were kind enough to stop by our Washington, D.C. studios while they are on tour. So what else can you play for us?
Oh, Viviré Para Ti. This is a song called Viviré Para Ti. In the record, we collaborate with a very famous Mexican artist, Natalia Lafourcade.
Okay, let's hear it.
Mentor.
lentamente, yo te toco dulcemente. Anda, quédate en mi mente, hagamos que este amor reviente. Tú serás la que me inspire, me consienta y me domine. No dejemos que termine, precio haré que te fascine. Viviré para ti.
Very nice. Do you miss home?
We go there a lot.
Oh.
But we do miss certain things.
The politics are a little intense right now. Internal politics in Venezuela, between the U.S. and Venezuela. And I just wonder, does that make its way into the music?
Our band has, I mean, each individual has their own view. Actually, we pretty much have one view. But our music is not about politics. Our music is about letting go and having people actually take their minds as far away from politics and everyday life as possible. That hasn't yet gotten into the music, but that's another thing.
Yeah. No, I'm just asking because a lot of times artists find themselves at the apex. People sometimes look to artists to express their feelings when they can't through other means, and sometimes you get drafted, I mean, even if you don't volunteer.
And you know what, Michelle? Since we started, that question is always being asked to the band. Like, okay, come on, how you guys don't talk about politics? And I think right now the tension is pretty bad. But by the beginning, it was also kind of the same publicity for politicians, and we were like really exhausted and really tired about. Man, it's 24 hours talking about politics, so we're going to talk about something else. Sex, love, cheating.
Because that's never discussed. You're right.
No, it's never discussed. No, but actually, the greater majority of the bands in Venezuela that were, like, you know, I mean, I, of course, opposed to salsa and merengue, but any rock band or any ska band or punk band or whatever that was around would talk about politics. And political situation in Venezuela has always been bad. Now it's actually worse, to the point that you have to choose sides, which I don't agree with at all. I don't think you should choose sides. You should try to work together. But, I mean, in Venezuela, we're considered opposition. Mm. And it has actually led us to certain issues with, we've lost shows, whatever, blah, 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 you know. But we still choose that it's, I mean, what we try to do in that sense is bring people away from that and make people feel better, as opposed of just reminding them what they're going through every day.
How do you think being in New York has influenced the music? Being
do you want to
Cheo?
I mean, Cheo wants a mic.
Yeah. No, I think I think we all agree that, you know, it brings like a lot of influences. It's like a place where a lot of people go through, and a lot of great music, a lot of great scenes, and being outside your country makes you like conscious of all what you had there in front of your nose. So it's a win-win situation in both ways. I love New York.
All right. Well, speaking to Brooklyn in the house right here. So to that end, I understand that the song we were going to go out on speaks to that, being in New York and thinking about, you know, what you left behind. Do I have that right? You want to play?
Yeah, it was written over in New York, Playa Azul.
Playa Azul, which means
Playa
Azul,
Blue
which
Beach.
Literally means Blue Beach. And so when we listen to this, should we think of ourselves sort of sipping something cool on the beach or what?
Well, it was written because we were in a snowstorm in New York, missing Venezuela. That's pretty much the reason why. So it's imagining yourself on a blue beach with your loved one.
With a piña colada.
Okay, that sounds good. That sounds good.
I love piña colada.
Well, we've been visiting with Los Amigos Invisibles. They're currently on tour supporting their Latin Grammy-winning album, Comercial. To learn more about the band and to see a video from their performance, please check out our website at npr.org. And now we're going to hear Playa Azul. Thank you all so much for visiting with us.
Contigo en una playa azul, oyendo bossa nova y tú, dejándote besar.
That's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow. Thank you.
horizonte y tú dejándote besar.